Thank you, Your Honors. Richard Bland, registration number 8203, representing the appellant Martin Sternbach. I think we can all agree that Mr. Sternbach is nothing if not tenacious. About 14 years ago, he was the victim of a fraudulent scheme along with numerous other investors. And if he hadn't done anything about it, he had just let it lie and not taken the steps that he did to secure those funds for himself, for the benefit of himself and his other investors, we likely wouldn't be here today. And in this case, his tenacity is once again being put to the test. This is the second time this case has been up to this court. Previously, the court partially reversed, but partially affirmed and sent the case back for proceedings on Mr. Sternbach's unjust enrichment claim. He is determined to have his day in court, to have his case put in front of a court of equity, which is what his remaining claim is about. And this court must decide whether the courthouse in Boulder, Colorado is going to be reopened, or whether the key will be thrown away and he has to go away. That's what this case is about today. As I said, this case involves a court sitting in equity. And one of the first things that should be considered in this case is the wrongful acts of the defendants.
That's an interesting question, because I noticed that in your brief you allude to the acts that would have also fallen under the tortious interference with contract parts, and in opposing counsel's brief they studiously ignore them, and neither one of you tell me why they should or should not be considered at this point.
Well, I thought I explained why, but I will reiterate that. Both the defendants and the trial court, as you said, studiously avoided looking back to the original wrongful acts.
Well, I'm not sure that's quite correct, counsel, because when you look at the trial court's ruling, it sets forth the entire claim, including the allegations of the wrongful acts, and it never says, I'm not considering it. It just has this generic, the circumstances don't arise to permit that conclusion that it was unjust. So I'm not sure the trial court rejected those other wrongful acts, but I know opposing counsel does.
Yes, and I think you cannot do that. I think you have to look at the complaint, the entire course of conduct of the defendants, in assessing whether there was an injustice done.
Is there any problem with Sternbach 1? Did that opinion intimate that that conduct should or should not be considered as part of the unjust enrichment claim?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. And if you look at our complaint, it clearly outlines the unjust enrichment claim as being reliant on both the original wrongful acts as well as the subsequent conduct. The only reason that the Court of Appeals in the first case looked and emphasized the subsequent conduct was to set the stage for when that cause of action accrued. And the wrongful conduct of the defendants began with the original poaching of the clients, but it continued. It was part of the original scheme. That was the whole idea, was to take these clients from Mr. Sternbach and then let him do all the work.
Well, Mr. Look.
there's nothing in the original opinion that forecloses those facts, which were obviously relevant and predicate to the tortious interference claim, from also being considered and being part of the unjust enrichment claim.
Go ahead, I'll yield to my colleague.
All right, a couple questions along those lines. Let me give you a hypothetical. Let's say that there were no allegations of wrongful conduct from the outset. You simply have two sets of lawyers representing two different sets of plaintiffs in a class action type of lawsuit.
Mm-hmm.
One of them does a lot of work and the other one doesn't do anything. Okay, at the end of the day, there's a big settlement and they share it. Is there a claim?
Well, I don't want to answer that definitively, but that is certainly not our case.
Well, but it's important. In that circumstance, is there a claim?
I don't think there's an unjust enrichment claim.
An unjust enrichment.
Right. I think he may have a claim based on a common fund doctrine, some
right.
fees. Based upon his work, he may get more fees than the other attorney because of his work in the case. But there would be nothing in those facts that would implicate unjust enrichment in terms of the fees received by, there would have been nothing wrongful about the fees received by the other attorney.
All right, in that
set of facts.
And that's what I thought you would say, sort of follow up. Where that leads me is that your case is dependent upon tortious interference with contract. I mean, that if you don't have that, then you don't have the unjust enrichment, but that's already been dismissed. This seems like tortious interference through the back door.
Well, Your Honor, it's common for the same set of facts to support multiple theories. So I don't see anything unusual about the fact that there was a tortious interference claim that has been time-barred from somehow magically making irrelevant the wrongful conduct that led to the unjust enrichment of the basically diverting those funds.
But
those
isn't
are two
the law
claims.
Isn't the law clear though that when you have a remedy at law, and you had one, you simply didn't file it timely enough, but where you have a remedy at law, you don't have a remedy in equity.
Well, I don't see that as part of, I have never seen that as part of the elements of an unjust enrichment claim. Certainly that has not been argued in this case, that because there was originally a remedy at law for that had something to do with the unjust enrichment claim, that somehow defeats the unjust enrichment claim. I have never seen a case to that effect. Now remember, the unjust enrichment claim, the issue would be the loss to my client. That's what his damages would be.
What's the loss?
Well, in the original loss, it would have been in the original tortious interference case, he would have had to prove how much he would have lost because he lost these nine clients. The focus in the unjust enrichment claim is not on his loss. That's not even an element.
It's on the benefit conferred.
It's on the benefit received unjustly.
No, it's on the benefit that your client allegedly conferred, okay? So what is that? I mean, I don't see anything in the briefs about what that is. I see what your client's trying to do is take all the fees and costs that were conferred on the other group of plaintiffs, but I see nothing about the benefit, the value benefit that your client conferred.
The use of the word conferred, I think, is misleading. The element starts with a receipt of a benefit at someone else's expense.
Well, at your client's
right,
expense.
And that's what happened. There's no doubt that they received $700,000.
And how is that at your client's expense?
Because it was his original effort, time and money spent to find the funds originally, trace them to Liechtenstein, freeze them in Liechtenstein, follow the funds back to the federal court in California, then take an appeal to the Ninth Circuit.
All of which your client would have done anyway. All of which.
That's
still
true.
Got 15 clients.
That's true.
Still would have done every bit of it.
That's true. But the point is that the defendants put them in the position, deliberately put themselves into the position by taking something that didn't belong to them, wrongfully acquiring someone else's clients. There's going to be a fee generated from the recovery of those nine clients. They deliberately put themselves in the position to get those fees, knowing that Mr. Sternbach was going to make the effort and do all the work.
That sounds an awful lot like a tortious interference with contract.
Well, it was. Those are two different claims.
Mr. Bland, let me ask you this. Is there any way that you can state an unjust enrichment claim without having to rely on the wrongfulness that your tortious interference claim had asserted?
It's hard for me to say, Your Honor. I do think that there is a common fund doctrine at issue where one person does all the work and there would be an entitlement to funds regardless of any wrongful conduct. I cited the case that the whole common fund doctrine it has its roots in unjust enrichment. But again, that's not the essence of what makes this particular case an unjust enrichment claim.
Well, we understand your argument that you know there's a combination, but if there was a reading of Sternbook 1 that suggested the tortious interference part should not be considered, that leaves the claim is that due to common fund unjust enrichment cases support a claim for unjust enrichment.
I don't think the court intended to make the prior acts, the wrongful acts, irrelevant. I did not read that.
Let's just assume they did. And, you know, do you have a claim for unjust enrichment based on a common fund type of unjustness?
Absolutely. I think that's a viable claim. But again, I don't think that's the, to beat the dead horse, I don't see how the mere fact that one claim has been time barred can somehow make the underlying facts of that claim irrelevant, somehow magically irrelevant for another claim that's based on a different legal theory. It's an equity. And the fact of the matter, one way or another, he doesn't have a legal claim. If he had one, it's no longer there. That's what equity is for.
I'd like to get back to this idea of the benefit conferred, though, because the word conferred I didn't just make up, it's from the cases. I'm just trying to figure out what's the value of the benefit conferred, because again, there's nothing in the briefs about that. It's all about the attorney fees, and I want to point out, now your client apparently wants not just the attorney fees that were recovered, but the costs that were recovered, whereas in the previous case, they only mentioned the attorney fees. But aside from that, what's the value of the benefit that your client conferred?
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I think a fundamental issue here is that the court, both the court and the defendants, looked at this case as if it was a quantum merit case. This is not a quantum merit case. Quantum merit is one species of unjust enrichment. It is not the only, and in that case, then you have to look at the value of the benefit conferred. That is the nature of the recovery. Here we have a different thing. There was something that the defendants received this windfall. And the question is it just or is it not just for them to retain it under the circumstances?
But it happens in class actions all the time. You have attorneys representing some parties and attorneys that do all the work, and guess what? The attorneys who don't do anything still get paid.
Exactly. But the difference is the defendants in this case could have proceeded honorably and competed fairly to get those clients, and they didn't.
But that's tortious interference.
Well, it happens to be tortious interference, but it's also unjust, wrongful conduct. What they did was wrong, whether it was tortious interference or not. They slandered my client to his own clients. And as a result of that, nine of those went over to them, and then they sat there, and then they received $700,000 as the fruit of that wrongful conduct.
So bottom line is, your client wants to be treated as if he continued to represent the nine.
No.
Well, that's what he wants, his recovery is he wants to...
No, because he may not, his loss, you know, his deal, I think, was less. He originally had a 10% fee, so his loss, if you look at his loss, it may have been much less than that.
So he wants more than he would have gotten if he would have continued to represent.
It's not a question of what he wants, and the court of equity can fashion an equitable remedy. They may disgorge 100%. A court of equity could disgorge less than that. They could fashion an equitable remedy. The court may even say, we'll disgorge the whole thing to you, but you return a percentage of it back to the original nine clients. I think that's all within the court of equity's discretion. And with that, with your permission, I'd like to retain another the remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Dave Sanderson, 20696. This court, in its prior opinion, explicitly left open whether the remaining claim of this extensive, protracted, and complex litigation could survive an analysis based on failure to state a claim. So the defendants moved to dismiss for failure to state a claim, which the trial court granted based on this conclusion that defendant did not, that plaintiff did not sufficiently allege any of the three elements that this court specified in its order were necessary. Namely, that defendants received a benefit, two, at the plaintiff's expense, three, that would make it unjust for defendants to retain that benefit. The argument we make is that in sum, the plaintiff cannot connect the dots for an unjust enrichment claim because those dots are missing. At most,
why can't he through the common fund doctrine analogy? Why can't he? When basically you've got two sets of lawyers and one set of lawyer does all the work, why can't the first lawyer come in and say, wait a minute, I should get a share of that recovery as well?
Your Honor, at most, what the plaintiff is claiming is that he did work for himself and his clients that he necessarily would have done. Recall that he was one of the people that claimed to have been defrauded. At most, and under the analysis of whether this plaintiff stated a claim for an unjust enrichment claim, at most, he claims he did work for himself and his clients well after the defendant supposedly contracted separately with the nine clients he complained of.
Let me come back. We'll get to the, you know, the tortious interference and should or shouldn't it count. But my question is just the idea about, hey, if I do all the heavy lifting and you're just along for the ride, why should you get anything when I'm the one who's basically conferred a benefit on your clients?
Your Honor, I see nothing that the plaintiff has cited indicate there's case law or authority to support that under an unjust enrichment claim.
Well, let me ask you, the common fund doctrine cases suggest that it's based in unjust enrichment principles. Why cannot it be used as analogy to support the unjustness of your clients retaining all or part of their fees?
I don't think that's what the plaintiff's complaint alleges, Your Honor. I think this case comes down to the fundamental argument is that everything he's talking about today, the question is, has he alleged it sufficiently in that complaint? That's where the trial court decided he didn't do that. And that's where this court originally left open the explicit question and invited this analysis.
It did invite the analysis, but because the trial court says it so, we should accept it as being so? We should not have an analysis ourselves?
Well, no, I'm not suggesting that this court doesn't have the ability to look at this and make some decisions, but the fact is that the trial court carefully analyzed what was in that complaint, and I think it cued off what this court focused down on originally. Remember, this court, in its original decision, really outlined what was left, addressing the tortious interference question. This court said that plaintiff's unjust enrichment allegations are really framed by its plaintiff's complaint at paragraph 12 and paragraph 15. And this court said Goss and Smith, it is alleged in paragraph 12 that Goss and Smith recovered funds for their clients, including Sterling Brooks former clients, in the words of the Court of Appeals, only by taking unfair advantage of his efforts. Was nowhere in the complaint of those unfair advantage described or factually supported. The second element that this court focused on was, according to paragraph 15 of the complaint, that Goss and Smith, quote, contributed nothing, not time, effort, knowledge, or funds, to the costly effort to recover the client's money, but they and their clients benefited handsomely from the work done by Sternberg and his co-counsel. And I submit that the Court of Appeals in its original decision is focused the trial court eventually on those two allegations and asked, are those sufficient to state a claim for unjust enrichment? We don't know. We don't decide that today. We'll leave that. And then they moved on.
Counsel, let me ask you this. Going back to the common fund analogy that was raised in some of the allegations, why wouldn't it state a claim for unjust enrichment to say and I'm leaving out the unfair and the wrongful pieces for this question. One, Goss and Smith recovered funds for their clients. Two, Goss and Smith contributed nothing, no time, effort, knowledge, or funds. Three, and their clients benefited handsomely from the work done by Stern Buckley's counsel. Why doesn't that state a claim for unjust enrichment?
Because the wrongful part that you omitted from the question, I think, is necessary under the case law. It's the third element that this court laid out for an unjust enrichment claim, which is the only claim he makes, it's the only claim that's left.
Does the case law of Colorado require in all circumstances the wrongful element?
All the case law I've seen, Your Honor. And again, those three elements, including the third, that it would be unjust, this court stated in its opinion. And I think the plaintiff, the defendant, and the trial court really took that language from the Court of Appeals decision and said, all right, we can all sort of agree on what the three elements left are. Let's look at the complaint and see if he's pled them. And that's why I think we find ourselves where we are today. Plaintiff's argument that, in effect, what he's arguing is that the defendants were more than innocent bystanders. He's trying to make the argument that what defendants did was wrong by saying that they're more than innocent bystanders, therefore he meets all three elements of the unjust enrichment claim. But the trial court concluded that regardless of how they are labeled now, that plaintiff's complaint failed sufficiently to allege that what defendants did was sufficiently unjust, regardless of what facts you consider. Regardless, if you go back to the tortious interference facts, and I think that's what the trial court looked at.
Why can't we consider the tortious interference facts? Counsel argued that, the idea that a claim is time-barred doesn't necessarily make the facts relating to that claim irrelevant. Why can't we consider those?
I think there's a lot of reasons. One, I think, I read the Court of Appeals' original decision as saying that claim is out. What's left is the equitable claim. The question is the complaint fill the state claim? Secondly, I think the trial court did. I don't think the trial court ignored any of the facts that were alleged. If it did, I didn't see that. Thirdly, I don't think it matters. I think if you look at plaintiff's complaint and say, regardless of whether or not it states tortious interference, does it state an unjust enrichment claim? Was there a benefit that was conferred? Was it wrongful, etc.? I don't think he needs those elements. I think that's what the trial court decided. So, I think there's lots of reasons why the facts under the tortious interference don't carry the day.
So you think that even considering the facts as alleged, that basically your client poached his clients, that would not make the turn into a unjust enrichment case?
Absolutely not. Because at the time they allegedly poached those clients, what was there? There was nothing.
No, I think he's arguing that it's, poaching the clients plus doing no work equals, he should be rewarded, not your client should be rewarded.
Well, Your Honor, there's lots of lawyers in this country and in many jurisdictions, and I haven't seen one case that's been cited to suggest that's a claim. That would be a new claim. Nowhere does plaintiff's complaint allege that he was induced to do anything by the defendants, or that but for some wrongdoing on defendants' parts, he would not have performed the services that he ended up performing, that for which he was handsomely compensated. I submit that to allow the plaintiff to recover yet more money from others for any recompensated work and expense he supposedly and necessarily incurred in his own behalf truly would be unjust. There is no allegation in the complaint that defendants knew about any of Sternberg's efforts. Nothing alleged in there. Such knowledge or lack of knowledge, I think, goes to the elemental issue of whether defendants' alleged conduct was unjust. The trial court found the unjust element was also not sufficiently stated. There is no logic in plaintiff's claim that the defendants wrongfully, quote, diverted the fruits of Sternberg's labors from Sternberg to themselves. Because at the time of the alleged diversion, there were no fruits. There was nothing to divert. It could have been a disaster. It could have been a legal malpractice lawsuit down the road, or something very bad that ended up happening. At the time the nine was supposedly diverted, there was nothing that had been done. There was no money, no funds, there was nothing. A lot of work, perhaps, but nothing else.
Let me ask counsel about two other issues in the case. One is that the trial court erred in denying the motion to amend the complaint. Did Mr. Sternberg allege that he did, or that defendants did know of his efforts? Marie said in the complaint, there's no indication that defendants knew of Sternberg's efforts to reclaim the money. In any of the amended allegations, did he allege that?
My recollection is that he didn't, and unless it comes under, there are numerous references in the proposed amended complaint that begin with upon information and belief. And it would probably be there if it was anywhere, but I don't recall saying that. He's making the allegation now, in fact, in his I think it's in his reply brief that that should be inferred. And recall also, with respect to the amended pleadings, plaintiff himself is characterizing those proposed amendments as, quote, simply adding a few additional factual details. Which to me is another reason why it should have been denied it anyway, because if we're just adding a few factual details, we've had years to add a few factual details to this case.
You may have had years to add a few factual details, but apparently nobody thought there was a claim lacking until the Court of Appeals suggested it in Sternberg 1.
Well, the issue of failure to state a claim was set forth in plaintiff's original answer. Defendant's original answer.
Right, in elaborate form?
Your affirmative defense, it was set forth as an affirmative defense.
Okay.
As far as I look at the case law, is sufficient to preserve the argument.
It is sufficient to preserve the argument, but on the other hand, I'm not sure that it's necessarily sufficient to say, aha, they're at fault, or years afterwards they never alleged anything else. I'm not sure that mentioning it in an answer is sufficient after an appeal to say they should have alleged it a lot earlier.
Well, I can find no case law that seemed unsighted to support the argument that it's somehow defendant's fault. That regarding the timeliness of the issue.
I'm not saying it's your fault. All I'm saying is I'm not sure you can claim it's their fault.
Well, Your Honor, I think they've got the burden of stating a claim. And the trial court looked at it. And, you know, regardless, the motion was labeled a 12b-5 motion for failure to state a claim. There seems to be plenty of case law to say the court could have treated that, this court can treat that, as a 12C motion. And I think you end up in the same place. I don't think the hyper-technical argument that defendant makes in, the plaintiff makes that somehow this should have been a 12B5 motion, it should have been some other kind of motion. I think that argument fails for a lot of reasons. One is, he stated it made sense to do it that way. And that's how we proceeded, that's how the trial court proceeded. There was no objection made. There was only been a subsequent objection made. But even if you look at some of the more recent case law that this court has decided, this court has the ability to say, you know, that should have been treated as a 12C motion. It doesn't really matter whether it was labeled a 12B5 motion. And you end up in the same place, which is that the case is dismissed or failure to state. I think to allow the plaintiff to proceed on an inherently suspect amended claim, which adds only a few additional factual details, at this very late date goes against findings of this case, the law of this case, including the findings by the two trial judges below, and rewards the plaintiff for his own dilatory behavior as prejudicial to defendants and will unnecessarily and unduly prolong this case contrary to CRCP 1.
Thank you, counsel.
if we learned anything from this argument today, it's the very fact-intensive nature of an unjust enrichment claim. And if you read Lewis versus Lewis, it talks about even on review, a finding of unjust enrichment or not is reviewed for abuse of discretion. So I think the lesson of this argument is we're trying to decide this unjust enrichment claim based upon oral argument, based upon the bare facts of a notice pleading. And I think this case should go back, all the facts involved, both before and after the clients were poached, should be looked at, and a trial judge sitting in equity should look at all of those facts and make a determination, an equitable determination. Is this an unjust enrichment or not? And then he can fashion an appropriate remedy. It may be disgorgement, it may be partial disgorgement, but this case needs, all the facts need to come out. And in terms of the knowledge, I would submit to you that that is at least inferable from what we alleged originally. We certainly alleged it explicitly in the proposed amended complaint, and we certainly could have introduced evidence of knowledge based upon the original complaint.
Counsel, thank you for your argument.
Thank you.
Thank you both, counsel, for your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. Thank you both.
Thank you.